your source for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Coming to you live and direct from my subterranean lair, my name is Ra, and I'm here to awaken the dormant particles that are spiraling inside your DNA. So come with me as we go further down the mystical spiral of life. It's Spiral Radio, where each and every week we unveil the different shades of you, the different shades of me, until we all vibrate the same frequency, and it's a half full moon. I think it's in Virgo tomorrow, July 1st. It'll be in Libra. I got a little bit of a summer cold, but Spiral Radio is still rocking. We got Fallen Angel Friday once again, and we have Fallen Angel expert, our buddy Gary Wayne from Genesis6Conspiracy.com, and we plan on uncovering what happened in the Book of Enoch. Did Enoch end up in Inner Earth or Agartha? Are these linked to other realms? One of them being the realm of the Naga that Hindus called Patala. Is this surrounded by time gates or interdimensional portals possibly leading to the Pleiades? We plan on uncovering these mysteries here on Spiral Radio tonight. And I want to welcome Gary Wayne from Genesis6Conspiracy.com to Spiral Radio. Welcome again, Gary.
Well, so happy to be back and really looking forward to the show. I think you've got a very interesting topic set up and really looking forward to having the discussion.
Thank you. You know, and it's such a pleasure to have you on every time, Gary. And the last show we did about the Persian giants and all that was really one of my favorite shows I've ever done. And we got a really good response. And even my friend James Bartley, who's a researcher, and he has a show called The Cosmic Switchboard. He told me he wants to have you on his show as well. So, you know, definitely new ears are hearing your work and your research, and hopefully we'll be able to get a few more people to hear who you are and what you're all about tonight. So let's just dive right into this Book of Enoch and what Enoch experienced. I mean, when I think in the beginning of the book, he talks about how the clouds invited him in, and how the mist summoned him. So I'm thinking a lot of these mist stories where someone sees a colored mist or some kind of mist is some sort of technology, and almost like enchanting the person to walk towards the portal or walk towards whatever is transporting them through realms or through wherever they're going. And when Enoch saw this vision, and he was welcomed by the clouds and enchanted by this mist, He said he was lifted upward, and he ended up going into, you know, either he said the heavens, but I'm thinking that he went into inner earth. He said he was surrounded by crystals, tongues of fire, which could be volcanic calderas, you know, things like this. So I'm wondering what your take is on this, Gary, and, you know, and if it was possible that, you know, Agartha is not just a myth, but it's actually a tube that's going from south to north pole, and there might be civilizations and other interdimensional portals and access to other realms within Earth.
Yeah, certainly the references that you're making to Enoch opens up doors to areas that just go in a, you know, a thousand different directions, because you just start to ask so many questions, right? And so I think if you look at Enoch closely in terms of what they're talking about, I think he's talking about two different places. I think he goes and just so the audience understands, is if we look at the spiritual realm as where God is, and this is where the angels tend to dwell outside the physical world in a different dimension, then if he goes up and into the clouds to the heavens to see the angels, then that's going to another dimension. Just as one wonders whether or not when he does the trip in another direction to see Middle Earth, is that into another dimension, or is that actually in the earth? And that's when you start to get into these questions about these portals, because whether or not it's a portal down into the earth, or and perhaps into that leads into other dimensions, or you're going into a dimension into the spiritual realm where the spirit beings are, as Christians we know those as angels and God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit, but you're still using a portal.
Yeah, and I think they're all interweaved with each other. I think that maybe when he's talking about the 12 winds and their portals, and how at the ends of the earth there are 12 portals open to all the quarters of the heavens, that maybe that there is some sort of inner earth, but it's more to it. That maybe the earth and the inner earth and the access points to inner earth are surrounded by these time gates or these portals that lead to other dimensions and other alternate timelines, and to maybe this holographic spirit universe that we call the realm of the angels, or, you know, all different realms. And like he says, you know, some of these realms are desolate and filled with, you know, chaos and cold and hail and sleet. And some of them are filled with beautiful waters and you know, good things. So maybe it's these different dimensions leading to different areas, and maybe these Naga that we call, you know, are just one of the realms, and the Fae are just another one of these realms that these portals lead to, or time gates. And I think that they might even be a some kind of defense mechanism. Like like if you enter into one of these these passageways and you're not invited, that you end up in some ulterior dimension on some ulterior timeline.
Well, I think you'd want to be careful if you were invited into some of those realms.
Think of Enoch. He was invited, though, right?
Exactly.
He was summoned.
Which is a whole different ballgame. And what's interesting is in one of the areas that he's taken to, and he takes several trips in the Book of Enoch, first Book of Enoch, is one of them in chapter 22. It's actually called, under a high mountain, it's called the Underworld, and there's four hollow places that are deep and wide, in those places it's got fountains of waters and things like that, but it's the Underworld designation that is sort of the connection to the dots here, and the Nagas were the gods of the Underworld, so you have an instant connection there.
Yeah.
And when you're in the fairy realm and you connect those to the Tuatha Danann or the Tuatha Danu, then understand that they're other world as well is just another name for an underworld. And so you start to get all of these different connections from different cultures, whether it's the Greeks with Tartarus, and which is very similar to, you know, the prison that Azazel is talking about. In fact,
yeah,
Abyss is even translated in First Peter as either Tartarus or Abyss, depending on which translation that you're talking about. So we get these overlaps of all of these different sources from around the world that seemingly are talking about similar topics.
Yeah, and I think that when they talk about Semyaza or Azazel being bound in the Abyss, I think that it might be within Earth and these volcanic eruptions, and in Hindu lore, Gary, you know, they say that Naga are linked to volcanic eruptions and earthquakes, and I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, I think that something may be imprisoned within Earth and may be awakening now, and that it might be tied to these calderas opening up, possibly in Yellowstone and Italy, you know, all over the Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're correct that the Abyss is likely in the Earth, and certainly Enoch would place it in the Earth, and it's like a shaft or one of those tubes that's attached to a greater area, just as in Revelation 9 it's called a shaft, and an angel is sent down to open that up as you go into the end time. But certainly there's no doubt that when you get into the Book of Enoch, it is saying that, you know, the Abyss is in the Earth, and, you know, it's located in the valleys of the Earth as well, and which is another indication that it's going, you know, deep into the Earth. And it's located in, you know, other chapters like verse 18 or chapter 18. It talks about it being at the end of the Earth, and it's a very, very deep abyss with columns of fire. In the second book of Enoch, you know, because this is where the impassioned angels were locked away according to Enoch, and in the second book of Enoch, the Abyss is not just a place of fire, but it's a place where two poles apart things are going on in terms of the torture that the watchers are being put under. One is fire and the other one is ice. So not only are they being tortured with the heat, but they're freezing at the same time. Like, this is not in a dimension as we understand it.
Yeah, you're right. And you know what? It even when he explains the 12 winds and their portals, he's talking about 8 of those dimensions being of bad, of hail, of sleet, of ice, and only 4 of them being of good, you know.
Yes.
So it's really not a wise decision to be invited and to take this, you know, because who knows. And you know, when you talk about the how one of ice, that made me think of the book of Job, Gary, and you know, I think it's in verse 38 where they talk about gates of death and ice and darkness and wastelands and all that stuff. And I'm thinking that it's possibly in the book of Job they're talking about something like this as well.
Well, Job has a lot of references to, you know, things that are underground and people in caves and things like that. And there's a lot of the hollow earth people from a Christian perspective sort of rally around Ezekiel and Job passages to support the hollow earth theory that they have. And you know, some of those verses, you know, they present an interesting case. I don't know whether it carries the whole way through as to what they're trying to represent it, but you have to recognize those verses as being there, and they are significant.
You know, now it's just a quick question. Now it just came to my mind. You know, you being of Christian faith, what's the general census of the Christian view for gray aliens? Do they ever discuss that, or do they even believe they exist, or anything like that? I'm interested.
Well, yeah, they're very curious about it. There's no doubt about that, and they want to know what the gray aliens and how the alien thing is sort of mixed in. And you know, the standard sort of understanding that Christians have is that it's a demonic and a fallen angel hoax. But the part that they kind of miss on this is some of these other beings like the gray aliens. And so, I got a great response in doing, especially doing a lot of shows on the gray aliens and matching that up to fairy mythology and fairy beings and connecting them back to the aliens and give them a better understanding as to what the whole alien concept is.
Yeah, you know, I'm doing the same kind of research now. In fact, on YouTube, I do my Fae Chronicles where, you know, these gray aliens are some sort of Fae, some sort of interdimensional being, possibly even created by a virus or some kind of like self-replicating antimatter that can form some kind of droid that can like terraform planets and genetically manipulate things. And so it may go even deeper than that, like some kind of high technology. And you know, even the Fae, how they're always fairies are always seen with that wand, Gary, and the wand has a septagram on top, and that septagram, I feel, is some kind of technology, and the and the wand beneath is the power source, and it may be opening up portals and opening up access to other realms with that wand. And the wand is seen in all cultures and all ancient manuscripts. It's talking about this wand, and I'm wondering what you think about that as well.
Well, when you get into the fairy mythos, it's an ancient mythos, and it's similar in its creation, and depending on which culture you're talking about, they all tend to be created from the gods. And so the Greeks have some of the more clear understanding of the creation of these little people, but there's three different groups of these little people as well. So the main group is called elementals, and then you have the ugly ones, which are like the gnomes and the hobbits and the dwarves,
Pup-budgies and the goblins, all those names, yeah.
And they have specific sort of things that they're supposed to do. Like when you look at Lord of the Rings, you see the dwarves living in sort of mountains and doing smithcraft. Well, that's traditionally what they did. But it was the gnomes that had that looked after the technology and looked after the records and the knowledge and the genealogies, right? And within the gnome classification, you have little gray, ugly, spindly-looking fairies, and some of them are called greys, and some of them are called gray neighbors, as they are in
some
Scotland.
Of them are, or even the red caps, where they're seen with the red caps, you know.
Yes, and these ones have flying machines and great technology, and they come through, depending on where you're pulling the information from, a fairy domain or a fairy mound or a shay or out of the water, out of some sort of portal, and they come through these flying machines. They kidnap people for a fortnight, as the Scottish one goes, and they return the people, and they don't have a memory of what happened. Under hypnosis and other techniques, people reveal that, you know, they've had sexual things done with them, DNA experimentation, very, very similar to a gray alien concept. And in fact, in my book, I put a fairy abduction description in there. And if you didn't know that I was describing a fairy abduction, you would swear it was a gray alien abduction.
Yeah.
And I think the fairy concept was an understanding in terms of the technology that people were at before the last 100 or 2 years. And now we're understanding them as different kinds of beings.
Yeah.
And again, these gray aliens, and there's many different types of aliens in the mythos, but they tend to come through portals and through, you know, portals in the water as well. And when we talk about fairies, they have not only the fairy domain, and domain means portal, but there are also people who guarded these portals. So again, they have another role in sort of that sort of ancient history that goes back. And fairies are part of that, what I would call that sort of greater Nephilim or giant concept, where you have all of these fantastic type of beings being created in ancient mythology and in prehistory. And you see sort of what happens at the end of The Lord of the Rings, which has a lot of this ancient history encoded into it from a Norse fairy mythology and sort of a real sort of, not a real, a Völkisch ideology. You see at the end an allegory of what's going on, because you see all of these types of beings sailing away on a ship, on a water, which is an allegory for the flood that they put in there. And then they say now it's the time for humans. So these beings disappear, at least from sight, while the age of humankind plays out.
You know, it's amazing. And it's interesting. So much of what you say has totally interlocked with my research and my experiences in my life and what's been passed down through my heritage from the Etruscans and from the Persians. And, you know, basically we believe that these beings are guarding access to the records, to the Akashic records, to the genetic memory of Gaia. And they have spirits for every plant, for every tree, for every – they have guardians, these astral guardians in a way. And they guard the technology and knowledge of the holographic astral universe. And, you know, they – if you're getting close to their entranceway to a portal in the woods or close to somewhere where there's access to their technology, then you can end up on an ulterior dimension trapped. You know, even where people are looking for you can hear them calling your name and you're in some like veil, some ulterior dimension where time is not passing like it is on Earth. Years are passing on Earth and you're just stuck in this ulterior realm. And there's been plenty of lore, you know, linking up with this. And, you know, we even have a legend in the Etruscan history or mythology, whatever you want to call it. And this ancient spirit is supposed to be the queen of all fae. Her name is Tirana. And a lot of these names end in ah. I think it's the vibration, the sound of the ah makes these a lot of these names are filled with that Tirana, that name, that ah sound. And Tirana was the spirit that was known as the Queen of the Fae. And there's one of these stories that says that if she sees anybody that is filled with great misery, that she'll appear and she'll wave her magic wand and she'll transport this person that's filled with misery to another realm where they'll become a king and they'll become filled with great treasures. And, you know, Tirana was known as the Queen of all Fae. And there's also the term Fae is said to come from the Fata or the Fates.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, there are three Fates in Etruscan yes. lore. Bafana, you know, there's two other ones, but one of them is Bafana. And even Bafana is where the hanging of stockings at Christmas time came from because they were giving gifts to Bafana in the stockings. So it goes really deep with these Fae, you know, beings.
Well, and the Fae are in the Greek mythology and in all throughout the sort of greater Italian peninsula mythology. And it overlaps into so many other cultures in a hundred different ways. And, you know, the Fae held, just as the fairies do, the fate of humankind, the destiny of humankind.
Yeah, right? And it's said that they even would interweave and lay out the pattern and blueprint for that person's spiritual life for each and every individual. Like they weave the fabric of that person.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're very, very powerful in the understanding of the pantheon of gods and these other beings and how they interrelate with the gods and the demigods. And sometimes the gods and the demigods sort of blur. But you're talking about these wands that not only the fairies have, but the fairy godmothers have these wands as well, right?
Yeah.
And the wands are also part of what the wizards have, right?
Yep. The wands and the cone hats. I think that those cone hats also, you know, amplify the psychic, you know, yes. the psyche.
Yeah, and when you look at what's being represented here, if it's a wizard and a wand, I mean, you're talking about the priesthood of the ancient mysteries. It's an allegory for the technology or the magic, and also known as the magi, right, where magic comes from. And yes. So that's the religious side that partners with the royal bloodlines and the kingships, which were typically the demigods, which were typically the offspring of the gods and human females, right? So they have this sort of organizational structure, and then they have all of these other beings that are working specifically for them as they ruled over the prehistoric world that, you know, Christians understand as before the flood or in the age of Atlantis and all of these other mythologies and religions around the world also talk about. And so when we also look at the fairy allegory goes back to the queen goddess, whether it's Gaia or Isis or Ishtar or Inanna, right?
Or Hera,
and the matriarchal bloodline of these gods through the demigods are also allegorized by the term fairy. So that represents the matriarchal bloodlines of the demigods. Just as the dragon represents the male bloodline. There's actually, you know, four. So you've got like owl and fairy together, and you have dragon and raven together. And those are allegories of the bloodlines. And typically they also represent a lot of what some of these individuals looked like back in prehistory as well.
And it's interesting, even too, like I mentioned, that the queen of the Fae in Etruscan is Turana. Even Turana is said to be Venus, like Turan. So it's interesting. They even associate Turana having like these cards where she would mystify people by throwing Venus, they would call it, throwing these cards. And so that's also connected to some kind of technology. And, you know, getting back to what I mentioned earlier, because I never heard you, we never got to that. But do you think that mist that summons Enoch is some sort of technology?
You know, I don't know whether it's technology or it's just sort of the ambience of the story. But certainly, you know, clouds are always associated with the gods. It doesn't matter whether it's the God of the Bible or Jesus returning, you know, as like clouds or the clouds that are around the mountains. It's just sort of part of that whole sort of environment. So, no, I don't know whether it's technology or not. But you know what? It could be some sort of reaction with the portals opening too, right? So
yeah.
That you've got, you know, different pressures and different temperatures and different things interacting that, you know, might produce that misty sort of cloud thing.
Yeah, and I feel that almost every forest has access to these portals or these entranceways that has access to the knowledge within the plant and within the trees and within everything on Earth. And these beings, these gnomes, these elves, these fae, they guard access to this knowledge. And I really feel that the underworld and beneath these trees and this lore is what they're talking about. And when we have 3 minutes to break, after we get back from break, I want to get into how one of these portals or dimensions might lead to the Pleiades, these seven sisters, and how I've dug up some information that might, you know, link up to this. And, you know, have you ever heard of the Billy Meyer case?
No.
It's a UFO case going back many years, and I think some of it was actually made up and debunked, but I feel that he did have some kind of encounter with these inner Earth beings. That
was that the one from the 50s?
Yeah, that he was calling Plejaran and Pleiadians.
Yep.
And, you know, it lines up with the Vril Society, Gary, and certain encounters they were having, and sort of like a Nordic Aryan type being. And I think that their origins could have been from the Seven Sisters or from the Pleiades, and possibly Jesus or could have been one of these. In Billy's stories, he calls Jesus Emmanuel, and that he was one of these Pleiadians and that he survived the crucifixion. And, you know, some of it is hard to believe. Some of it makes like it could be possible. But I found certain instances like in the New Testament where they're talking about the vision of a coming Messiah holding in his right hand the seven stars, you know, and to me they're talking about the Pleiades in that case. And I was wondering when we get back from break what your take is on that, and we could get more into these realms and where they may lead to, maybe even Patala of the Naga, and who Cecrops was of the Greek mythology, this half-human, half-serpent that was like a king, basically, for a little while. And We're going to get right into this back. We're with Gary Wayne, and it's Fallen Angel Friday. And you can find him at the Genesis6Conspiracy.com, and you can find me at themysticalspiral.com. And we'll be back in a few minutes after this song called Patagonia by Far Radio Clouds. And we'll be back in a few minutes. Spiral out.
Anywhere. Thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal. Para-X.
And we are back, and that was Far Radio Clouds with the song called Patagonia. And we are with my buddy, and it's Fallen Angel Friday, and we got Gary Wayne here from Genesis6Conspiracy.com. I got a little bit of a summer cold, but I'm trucking through. And, you know, Fallen Angel Friday, we do usually on the last Friday of every month. And Gary is a Fallen Angel expert. And, you know, Gary, before we go into the Pleiades topic, I just wanted to touch on how you mentioned the Magi. And, you know, being that that's where magic comes from, do you think that they're offspring of Semyaza? Because Semyaza taught herbal enchantments. He taught magic. This being taught magic to humanity. So is some Semyaza or Azazel or even Baphomet somehow related to these Magi?
Well, yeah, I think there's a definite connections there. And if you go back into prehistory and the cultures around the world, you talk about not just the seven major angels that are in the Book of Enoch, where you're referring to in terms of Azazel, but you have the seven Sebedi and the seven
mountains, even too.
Well, mountains as well, but I'm trying to think of some of the different orders that are around the world that are like the Nagas, that are like the seven sages, right? So they are taught in a priesthood by the Watchers, all of the knowledge and the religion. And so out of this brotherhood comes all of the development of the magic and the sciences and the religion, where Magi goes back to. And that's why you have that wizard imagery that goes with the polytheist allegories to the priesthood, right? Just imagine the priests of Egypt as an example. They're not shown in a wizardry type of allegory for the most part, but they're doing all sorts of magic, just as the Magi do, which are the Mesopotamian wise men from Chaldea.
So do you think the Buddha is related to these Magi as well, or his father could have been one of these Magi?
Well, typically in how Buddha is looked upon, he's not really looked upon as one of the Magi. He would be higher than what a priest would be, right? So Buddha is one of those individuals that they look at as sent to Earth to enlighten humankind and help them on the way to godhood, just as other individuals are, like Hermes or Zoroaster, and so many of the other sort of famous names out of history, as when it comes to religion. So he is a little bit greater than most of the Magi, I guess I would put it that way.
Yeah. Do you think he has Aryan Nordic roots?
Well, the Aryans are the ones who are believed to have settled into the Indus Valley shortly, you know, after the flood, and they brought with them the religion that and the language of Sanskrit. So, you know, Buddha and Buddhism comes out of this Hindu religion that is brought to them by the Aryans. So, and when you look at the sort of the Brahmin brotherhood there, that was an interfamily connection there, in terms of, to be a priest, you had to be part of the family, part of the bloodline, right?
Yeah.
And so one presumes then that Buddha probably comes out of that bloodline.
Yeah, and I think that is partly Naga blood. I mean, he has all these encounters with these Naga. I mean, there's this encounter that I talk about that I've heard. You know, I heard it maybe 20 years ago, and then recently I heard it again, and it just totally, you know, got me hooked when just reading about this. And it's talk about how the Buddha appeared at the Ganges River, and the Naga sensed the presence of the great Buddha and surrounded him. All these reptilians surrounded him on around the Ganges River and circled him, and they wanted to help him cross the river. So they all took off their robes, and because they all wanted to help, and the Buddha didn't want to let down any one of them, that they made like a whole bunch of bridges out of the robes instead of just one bridge. And then he transformed himself into four Buddha and crossed the four bridges. So he didn't let any of them down because he didn't want to, you know, disgruntle them. And then he laid to rest in another village, and then he converted this Ilapatra, who was 800 miles long and hung over the town of Benares. I mean, it's incredible, these stories.
Yeah. So, yeah, I do believe that these bloodlines that come out of the Nagas or the Watchers or the gods around the world, because we're talking pretty much the same type of story in every culture.
Yeah.
You know, they continued throughout history, and they continue to this day. And that is part of their belief system, right? That's part of their keeping the genealogies, and it's part of the bloodlines and sort of the whole ideal of real, the bloodline, something in the blood, and the gene of Isis that they like to talk about as well. So it's certainly important to the people of those religions in terms of those bloodlines and connecting themselves back to the demigods.
Yeah, and you know, even he's talking about in the Book of Enoch, I mean, how these portals are linked kind of to the power of the moon and the lights of the moon, and how, you know, the divisions of the stars according to their names, and how all they're divided and how they're linked to the stars. So I think that it is possible that one of these portals or these gateways described in the Book of Enoch are appearing, or, you know, some kind of gateway to the Pleiades star cluster. And this is also, I think, what the Nazi Vril were encountering. And I really feel that if this is possible and if this is really happening, that these, you know, revelations that are talk about, these dream visions, they're possibly seeing, you know, gateways to these other dimensions and other star clusters like the Pleiades. And it's like I said in Revelation, it talks about in the New Testament how the vision of the coming Messiah, and he's holding in his right hand the seven stars. And do you think that they're talking about the Pleiades as well? Because they talk about it in the Book of Job. They talk about the Pleiades in that as well. And I'm wondering if you think this is even possible.
Well, certainly, you know, Pleiades has more of an association with the flood than I think in terms of what Jesus is doing with those seven stars. And the Pleiades is also connected with Orion, and just as in Greek mythology, you know, the hunter Orion is hunting down the Pleiades, and it's generally in mythology, it's a couple or two or three stars from the Pleiades that are sent to the Earth to crash into the oceans to start the conflagration of cataclysmic events. That
is that like the Kuchina? You
know, yeah, that we know that is part of the flood story. So, I mean, the flood story is greater than just the flood. I mean, and even in the Bible, when it includes references to Orion and Pleiades, whether or not it's you know, in Job or it is in Amos, or even some verses in the Psalms, this is seemingly talking about the flood story. But I don't see a connection with Jesus to the Pleiades with the seven stars, I mean, or the seven angels or anything like that. So,
well, do you think it's possible that Jesus could have been from the Pleiades?
Well, Jesus would be the creator of the Pleiades as the Word of God, so probably not. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, you know, something that ties it all in together, too, with these Fae realms or Argartha, and also the Pleiades, and how one of these portals might lead to these Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters, is the Kiowa tribe. You know, they talk about this story, how these seven maidens were transported to the sky to save the tribe, you know, to save these seven maidens from these giant, huge bears, Gary. Huge, enormous bears. And the spirit, you know, put this devil tower in Wyoming, or Mateo Tepe, I think they call it, to place them beyond these giant bears. And those vertical lines that you see down Devil's Tire are said to Devil's Tower are said to be the claw marks of these giant bears. And I'm also thinking that Devil's Tower might be even like a fossilized, petrified ancient tree, you know, that may have been from or something. Yeah. You know,
and I was water, just
that's
mention...
like that's like water dripping down, that water erosion or something. But it's said that, you know, to keep these, since the bear was almost getting to them, to keep these maidens from harm, the spirit placed them in the sky as the seven sisters. And that's like almost saying that some kind of, and it's also in there's also lore in the Native Americans that beneath Devil's Tower is some kind of fae realm or underworld. So, you know, maybe
Orion is also known as a bear, right?
Yeah,
Atlas in Greek mythology was the father of the seven sisters or the seven Pleiades. And Orion the hunter was attacking and hunting the seven sisters. So there's a closeness to these stories around the world that just defy logic.
They really do. And you know, in, I mean, in Job, they talk about this, these seven sisters as well, or seven, I think they call it, yeah, the seven stars, you know, I think they call that in the book of Job. Let me see if I can find it. I have it in front of me. It's 38:31 in the book of Job. They say, can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons? Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? And, you know, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? You know, so they are talking about knowledge of, I think, these portals to these realms or these star clusters. And can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? What do you think they're talking about in the book of Job here, Gary?
Well, I think this is when we talk about Job. Job is very much about prehistory, and I think this is talking about, you know, the relationship between the flood story and what happened in prehistory. So I write a little bit about that in my book, you know, this connection and make the connections to the various accounts around the world. But I think it's I don't take it beyond that. And I'm listening closely to what you're saying, but I'm not really seeing a path to take it beyond what it's talking about.
Some kind of time gate to the Pleiades.
Yeah, no, yeah. But what we do understand is Orion and Pleiades are very, very important, right? And Orion is also where Azazel is said to be hung in some accounts as well. So, and Orion is also thought to be, you know, one of the great sort of Nephilim of the antediluvian epoch as well. So I won't rule out that it has something to do with the portals to the Pleiades, and certainly in the alien mythology you've got these connections to the Pleiadians and that they're coming back. But that's more of an Anunnaki type of understanding, yeah. Right? More when you get into that mythology.
Well, so when Enoch is talking to his son Methuselah about the deluge, is this sort of like, is he like talking about going off into paradise, where angels go off to measure paradise?
Mm-hmm.
Is Methuselah sort of, you know, these guys are living hundreds of years as well. Are they some kind of hybrid?
No, because what happens, you know, from a biblical perspective is that in Genesis 6, which is the same story of the Nephilim, and which is the same story that is the, you know, where the flood begins, is that immortal spirit that goes from the gods or the fallen angels into these demigod individuals, life is then stepped in, is going to be limited. God steps in and says, you know, I'm not going to permit gods in the physical world and in a physical body. So he limits all life to 120 years. So after those generations dissipate, then their lives become shortened as well. And you have great ages, like Noah lived to be 950 years.
But, yeah, Methuselah too, right? Wasn't he like 600 years or 900 years?
Yeah. So that was quite common coming out of, as descendants of Adam, out of the Garden of Eden. But because of what happened with the violations against creation in Genesis 6, God limits all life to 120 years for people after that, although it does take a few generations for that to click in.
Yeah, you know, and I wonder if he is talking about, Enoch is talking about Agartha or Inner Earth or some kind of, seeing some kind of mining operations even, when he's talking about the seven metal mountains and the elect one, and how he's seeing a mountain of iron, a mountain of copper, you know, silver, gold, all of these, even a mountain of soft metal and a mountain of lead. And he even asked the angel, you know, where are these things, you know, where am I coming from? Like, what are these things, you know? And, you know, so where are they? What do you think they are? He's talking about this.
Well, it's very clear. I mean, with what he's talking about, it's in the earth.
Right? Yes.
It's in the earth, and there's many many descriptions, whether it's in the valleys of the earth, but you know the most succinct one is in chapter 26, where he goes to the middle of the earth, right, as one of these locations. And so, and again, I mean, it's got in verse, you know, chapter 22, it calls it the underworld, right? And you've got these hollowed out places, which is, again, probably where so much of the hollow earth sort of ideology comes from. And so there's something going on, according to the Book of Enoch, inside the earth that matches up with so many other references from even from within the Bible, with Tartarus and the Abyss and other religions and mythologies around the world. And they all seem to point that is the underworld. That is a whole different world. Whether or not that's the case or not, from a physical aspect, or that's an entrance into another dimension, we don't know. But it is, it's quite clear Enoch is saying, like, it's in the earth.
Yeah. And so do you think that, you know, that being with the Hindu lore saying that the Naga are linked to earthquakes and volcanoes, that somehow these ancient fallen ones are bound within the earth, and that volcanic calderas erupting and possibly, like, all over the earth, these earthquakes and these natural disasters happening. And even for many years, we were hearing these loud booms all over the earth, almost like trumpet sounds. And do you feel this is something to do with these fallen ones awakening and returning?
No, not yet. I mean, certainly when they return, they're going to return all at once. At least from a Christian perspective, like when the keys to the abyss are open, they all come back, and including the crab, the scorpion beings as well. And so I think, no, it's not them awakening. There's a set time for that.
And how do you feel? How long do you feel this is from happening?
Well, I mean, I try not to make predictions. Most people who make predictions are always wrong in terms of.
Yeah, but do you think it's like we're at the cusp?
The end time and all of that happening from a Christian perspective, it's not here yet, but it seems to be on the horizon. And with knowledge, you know, developing as quickly as it is, and with the ability of quantum computers, which work in different dimensions, you know, that's working with the CERN project and other things that they're trying to get, seemingly from a human perspective, to be able to tap into these portals and perhaps, you know, open the abyss. I think we're getting closer all of the time, but these quantum computers have the ability to make things happen in a technological manner and a knowledge level so quickly, because, you know, what takes a supercomputer 500 years to compute, a quantum computer takes seconds.
Yeah, now they have these DNA computers as well.
Yeah, and what are they sequencing and what are they doing with that?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, we can start, you can imagine we can start doing and making beings like they made in mythology.
Yep. And, you know, these crystal caverns that he talks about in the Book of Enoch as well, and, you know, how they line up with the Hindu and Buddhist lore of the Naga being in crystal caverns.
Yep.
And, you know, also this, you know, we only have a few minutes left, so, you know, we're definitely going to have you back on another time. But one Greek legend that always really fascinated me in the last few minutes, if we have time to talk, was the Greek legend about Cecrops, who was actually an Egyptian, I think, Gary. And he mm-hmm. founded the city of Athens about 1556 BC. And he was mm-hmm. like a wise, tolerant leader who actually was said to have given people laws and taught them to cultivate the olive and things like this. And that, you know, some kind of dissension broke out. You know, whether the city's patron deity should be Athena or the sea god Poseidon. And Cecrops democratically put the matter to a popular vote. And then the woman had outnumbered the men by one, and they chose Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And the statue of the goddess with her serpent familiar was erected on the Acropolis, and a living snake was kept near her shrine as the guardian spirit of the city. But after 50 years of this reign, Cecrops died. And he had been a great ruler. in all respects except for one disturbing feature, and that was from the waist down. He had the form of a serpent, and Poseidon, he never forgot that the virgin goddess had bested him, and one day he surprised Medusa, who was then a lovely girl, and he prayed at Athena's shrine, and he raped her, and then ran away, and then Athena was furious at the desecration of her temple, and since the real culprit had escaped, she turned her hapless, rage, on Medusa and turned her into a monster, and her hair became vipers and turned her hands to brass, and she became in scales, and she, the whole story, her tusks were like a wild boar, and if anybody looked directly into her eyes, it was instant death. They turned to stone. So I was wondering what you think this story is and how evil Athena was to even, take a revenge on Medusa for no reason. And I think she even sent Perseus to kill Medusa to clean up her mess.
Yeah. I mean, so many different things going on with those myths. First of all, I mean, most people probably don't realize that serpent mythology is a significant part of Greek religion. Ancient Greek religion and ancient Greek mythology.
Yeah, they were serpent deities first. Yeah.
They were serpent deities first. They're not depicted that way for the most part in the modern age, but they're serpents just like the Anunnaki were serpent gods in Sumeria and the Nagas and all the other serpents around the world. Yeah. So that's the first thing. And the other thing that is very, very clear is that these seem to be more almost like demigods than gods because they don't act like good gods. They don't act like powerful. They act more like humans, right?
Yes.
So one wonders whether or not they're more demigod, and they are actually part human, but they're certainly posed as gods, whereas like the Titans and the offspring of some of these gods would be more like the demigods. But they, if the Greek account, which is similar to other accounts around the world of these gods fighting and doing ruthless things to them. This was a very chaotic age of prehistory ruled over by the gods or the fallen angels. And if there was indeed 4 to 9 civilizations, you just wonder how much chaos was actually going on around the earth. I mean, if the gods aren't getting along and they're attacking and destroying each other and doing certain things, you can only imagine as that goes down the food chain to demigods and then into humans.
Yeah, I mean, and that story with Medusa really goes deep. I mean, it goes really deep to like her when her head got cut off. The blood was like starting all sorts of things. And even like later on, Apollo was said to bring his son Asclepius to Athens to receive her blessing, and Medusa gave the boy the goddess Athena gave the boy Medusa's blood, and then he became the heal the sick with it.
Yeah, and of course that's the foundation, and he's the father of Hippocrates, who the doctors take their oath to. So it's kind of the start of that whole mythos of the medical association, which is why they have serpents wrapped around the caduceus of Hermes. But that's a different rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But and again, taking the head of Medusa suggests more of a demigod or an offspring of the gods, like a Titan or a Nephilim. Because again, in most of these accounts and mythologies, you're essentially having to take the head of the demigods to kill them properly.
And it's almost like the Highlander. There can only be one, Gary.
Exactly. That's called the quickening, right? Which is out of the fairy side of the mythology of absorbing the energy and killing them, taking the head. And so just as in the vampire movies, they're drinking the blood to gain immortality and to have better health and better cognitive abilities. Again, you have the similarity of the quickening, the Medusa story with Asclepius, and the vampire stories, understanding that the Nephilim, one of their great sort of sins, as it's recorded in the Book of Enoch, is drinking blood, right, for these purposes. And so this, is, again, seems to be a common sort of thing that went on in prehistory.
Yep, and we are with the one and only Gary Wayne, and you can find us at themysticalspiral.com, and you can find Gary and his book, Genesis 6 Conspiracy. at thegenesis6conspiracy.com. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. We're going to have Gary on for another Fallen Angel Friday sometime soon. And I want to thank my producer, Sarge, everybody in the chat room, like always, everybody out there on the World Wide Web. And I want to thank you personally for listening right now. And thank you again, Gary, for coming on. We'll have you again soon, and it's always a pleasure. And once again, I say, everybody say it with me, spiral out.